It was really good to see the team from the Czech Republic come back and run into various ones of you in the hall. It was nice to run into which Goswiller and Randy Hepler from Africa had just gotten back to. These guys still looked glazed and bleary-eyed, but Rich taught a Sunday school class. I can't imagine there was no heresy espoused considering his sleepy state of mind, but we're hopeful that it was not. We're also very glad to have Nate Hampton back from the Czech Republic. Yesterday, Nate was at a memorial service for his mother, Michelle's mom. And also, we're glad to have from the church in the Czech Republic, Clara Tumová, who is here visiting with us from the church that we have such good relationships with. It's a pleasure to have you folks all back or here for the first time. Imagine that you live in Chicago. And for 108 long years, you hear endlessly about the St. Louis Cardinals, or the Toronto Blue Jays, or the Atlanta Braves, or the New York Yankees. And finally, last year, the World Series becomes yours. There is something about an underdog, about a loser, about a person who just never seems to get what they so desperately hope for getting it, that lights us up so much more than just someone who wins all the time. This is the nature of the passage that we're in this morning from Matthew chapter 15, is the account of the woman who comes to Jesus who was put off by him, the only similar account in the entire Bible. I'd like to read from Matthew 15. We're going to start with verse 21. And when verse 21 refers to leaving that place, that place is the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, probably the town of Capernaum. Matthew 15, 21. Now leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And look, a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away. She keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It isn't right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." "Yes, Lord," she said, "but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." And then Jesus answered, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. Were there any number of things to say about this favorite passage that has helped so many people? But let's just take three of them. And I certainly probably have come up with things that you could come up with better ones because it is so very rich. One thing that is very clear from this passage is that, Christian, your salvation was very costly to God. It was not something that he accomplished with ease. It is something that he accomplished at great pains to himself. Someone has said centuries ago, "God will forgive me after death. That's his job." But it's not his job. There was nothing required about forgiving us. There is no need to forgive us. He has every reason to leave us in misery for an eternity. He knew the great sacrifice that it would take to come here and rescue us, and he knew that it would take an eternity for us to wrap our minds around the magnitude of the sacrifice that it took. And so Matthew wants to emphasize that, and the way he does it is in the manner in which he tells the story of chapter 14 and 15. Most of his book, Matthew tells his stories in a certain way. But in chapter 14 and 15, he tells his stories in a very different way. And it is this very different way that he goes about telling the story that Matthew is getting at for us, the fact that salvation was so very costly to our Father and to our Savior. Here is how it works. Think of the way that different people tell the stories of their vacations when they return. It's summer. Oh, the boys are back. If you want to hear about how they did, you could ask. Now, I suspect that if you ask a young boyer, you will get a substantially different answer from an older boyer. It goes like this. If you ask an older boyer, a dad, how vacation went, it is often given in a rather sequential, orderly, logical, and boring manner regarding vacation. Oh, yes, we took a vacation to Massachusetts. We were there visiting my sister's family. We decided to take the train for the experience. On the way up on the train, we sat in the cabin car with a man who had terrible cigarette breath, and it made all my kids gag. The first night we were there, our kids slept in a treehouse in a patch of woods behind my sister's house, and it was a great experience. The next day, we all piled into two cars, and we went into the city of Boston to tour around. I wasn't familiar with the city, and I had a fender bender when I was there. And then the rest of the week, we went to the beach, and while we're in the beach, young Jimmy got stung on his foot by a jellyfish. But other than that, we had a great time. Dun, 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 dun. If you ask a younger person what vacation was like, it is liable to be a little more over the map. We had a great, great, great time. It was a cabin in the woods. We slept in a cabin in the woods, and the guy on the train smelled like cigarettes, and Jimmy stung his foot with a jellyfish on the beach, and downtown Dad ran into somebody with a car. Bam, 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 bam. It's all true. Each individual thing is true, but you can't tell the order. Were you at the beach, or were you at the woods, and which was first, and were you driving a train or were you driving a car? Well, it doesn't mean that Matthew was usually helter-skelter, but it means that usually what he does, he takes a theme and tells stories around it, and then a theme and tells more stories around it, and so forth. But beginning in chapter 14, Matthew goes chronological. This happened, then that, and then that. What is he doing? Oh, what he's doing goes beyond what he says in any given story that he tells. By weaving them together, he is after his readers looking and saying, oh my goodness, did not our salvation cost the Son of God so very much? Here's how it works in these two chapters with him. In chapters 14 and 15, Matthew decides to share several days in a row of what Jesus' life looked like. So we get in a snapshot, compacted form, what his entire life must have looked like. And we think, my goodness, he did all that in those few days. What must his 3.5 years have been like? And so in chapter 4, he begins on the west shore of the Sea of Galilee. We know that because chapter 13 makes it clear that's what he was. Now, we read in chapter 14 that John the Baptist was murdered, and the news of it reached Jesus. And since that is so disturbing to the 12 disciples, doubtless, who saw John as the announced man, the go-ahead man, the precursor of Jesus, and since it deeply, no doubt, reached Jesus as well, and since we learn from the other Gospels that the crowds were pressing so much that they didn't even have time to eat, and that the 12 had just returned from their missions trip, and they were excited but exhausted, we read in chapter 14, verse 13, that Jesus, quote, withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. We talked about this a number of weeks ago, how Jesus wanted to go on, as it were, a vacation, time alone with the disciples to recuperate, to process the death of John the Baptist, to get away from the territory of Herod Antipas, who had killed John, and to just clear their minds and think and pray. When it says he withdrew, it's not just the word for he left. It's the word for to slip away, to disappear from someplace, to quietly back out and go somewhere else. It's the word that was used when Jesus and his family slipped out of Bethlehem in the middle of the night when Herod the Great was trying to kill all the infants in the town of Bethlehem. And so we read in chapter 14 that Jesus went from the western shore of Galilee to the eastern shore to a remote, quiet place where nobody would be there but 5,000 people on the shore as we pull up, because they all walked around the northern edge of the lake in order to be there when he got there. All day long, he heals these people. And you know what it's like to be around highly sick people all the time. You may care deeply, but it's draining because you enter into their suffering. At the end of a long day, he feeds them all. And so food is distributed miraculously to 5,000 plus people by the disciples. By now, it's night. And so now on that same day, Jesus goes into the hills to pray through the majority of the night. Do you find prayer to be easy or tiring? Do you find it easy to stay up late to pray or tiring? Have you ever tried to pray through an entire night or the majority of a night? It is extremely difficult. Meanwhile, he has sent his disciples by boat back to the western shore of the lake because this vacation spot is certainly not working. They hit a windstorm. They are rowing all night just about. We read that between 3 and 6 in the morning, they are still rowing. The Bible calls it the fourth watch of the night. That's what it is. And so Jesus walks on water out and he gets in the boat and they land back on the shore near daybreak. All this has happened in a mere 24 hours. And now it's all just getting started in Matthew's two chapters. As soon as he gets on that western shore, the crowds discover that he's there. And it says from all over the place, from miles away, they drag the people who are sick, lay them at his feet, and he heals them all. And as he's in the middle of that, the scribes and Pharisees show up now, not only with the local rabbis who were debating with Jesus and losing right and left, but now they bring in the big guns from Harvard. That is, from Jerusalem. The Sanhedrin, the majority scholars from the chief city of the whole country, and these men who are extremely well-versed in the Bible and extraordinarily intelligent, come at Jesus, bam, 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 finger on his chest. All this now in a 2 or 3 day period at most. And now we come to our passage, and it makes sense that in verse 21 of Matthew 15, we read, "Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon." Same word. The idea is, get us out of here for a little peace and quiet so we can think and pray and recoup. Why did he go to the area of the cities of Tyre and Sidon? One reason might be the climate. I think this was first noticed by a commentator named John Broadus in the 1800s. He said, think about it. When Jesus went from the western shore of Galilee to the eastern shore, he went to a hilly area because high up in the hills, it's cooler and you can relax. It's about March or April when all this takes place. It's hot as blazes in the Sea of Galilee, which is hundreds of feet below sea level. Now that that's not going to work, he goes far to the west. And all around Tyre and Sidon, oh, you have a coolness that you don't experience most places. First, they are seacoast towns. And so you get the constant breeze off of the ocean. And secondly, you get right behind them, if you're looking out at the ocean, behind you are the foothills of the Lebanon Mountains. They are the mountains that had the famous cedars of Lebanon. It's shady, it's cool, the elevation makes it a glorious, mild temperature, just delightful to be in. But I think there's a second reason that's a little more important why Jesus went to the areas of Tyre and Sidon, and that is not just its climate, but its actual location. Tyre and Sidon are in a foreign country. Some people have mistakenly thought that Jesus never left his home country, but it's not so. Here, it's very clear, and in Mark, it's even clearer, that he stepped outside the borders of Israel. He's going to a place where he will not be recognized. Wherever he went in that area of Tyre and Sidon, which is also known as Phoenicia, the closest he could have possibly walked was 30 miles from Capernaum. And possibly as long as 50 miles away. He's gone to great lengths to be anonymous so nobody knows who he is, so he can have a little time with his disciples alone. Why is all this significant? It's significant for this. Matthew wants us to know he can get no quiet in the east or west, that he has to leave the country. And the moment, it seems, or very soon afterwards, that he arrives in a foreign country, word still gets out. And verse 22, a woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." And it's clear she didn't just cry out once, but the disciples complain in verse 23, she keeps crying out after us. The word means that she's speaking at the top of her voice, and she keeps doing so. Apparently, they are walking, and she is following. And she is tapping on their ears the whole time to a weary Jesus who was not even sent in his lifetime to the Gentiles. And yet, shows Matthew, by the end of that exchange, that woman gets what she requests. Jesus is exhausted, but his compassion propels him to exercise costly ministry despite it. And Matthew wants us to think about the last 3 days. And thus we come to the words of that hymn we often sing about the remarkable life of Jesus. For us he prayed, for us he taught, for us his daily works he wrought, by words and signs and actions, thus still seeking not himself, but us. It's a marvelous thing. And this little 3-day period, or 4-day at the most, it seems to me, is meant to picture the entire life of suffering of Jesus, which will culminate in a slow death by crucifixion in which he will pay for the sins of the world. Human salvation is costly to God. And that is why the first half of a worship service is at least as important as the second half when you hear the sermon, and maybe more important. Because in the first half, it's when Christian people lift their voices and they give thanks to God for the costly salvation that he has given them. And do you not often come into church yourself exhausted, feeling like, I don't have anything to give. I don't particularly like this hymn. Oh, that's not my favorite worship leader. Oh, it's hard to be here today, Lord. I'd rather just be home in bed. That's okay. It's not wrong to feel that. But Jesus went to extraordinary cost in order to buy our salvation. And thus, when we come to him, often the costliest thing we can offer in return is to give it our focus and attention, even when the music is not our style or when we're tired on a given day. And I hope by God's grace we're able to do that when we gather to worship. Salvation, extremely costly to God. The second thing, Matthew says, that is not as immediately apparent, but as you read it, it becomes very clear, is that our salvation requires some understanding of the Bible. God, in this passage, through his Son, refuses to give salvation to a person who has no grasp of any Bible truth at all. Here's how this plays out in our passage. This woman comes to him with the suffering of her child. It is one thing to suffer yourself. It is another thing to watch someone you love suffer, whom you are powerless to help. And to watch a child suffer terribly is almost unbearable. This woman's child was demonized. We don't hear in this chapter exactly what it looked like in her case, and the effect of demons on people seemed to vary from person to person in the Bible and in many countries of the world today that you hear about. But these are the kinds of things that demons did to people. They would affect people in their bodies. Their eyes would often just glaze over and they were not able to communicate. They were often sick. They were often convulsed in their bodies, having seizures like an epileptic fit. Sometimes the demons would throw a person's body into a fire or into the water in an attempt to kill them. And then demons would have a huge effect, not just on a person's body, but on their emotions, their souls, their psyche. They were terrified, often, people were demon-possessed. Or they have a sense of darkness about them that they can't shake, that is dreadful. Or they are depressed continually beyond anybody's help to lift them out of it. And often people who are demonized are driven to do awful things they don't want to do, disgusting things they don't want to do. Just Friday night, I was talking to a missionary who spent the last 12 years, I believe, in Uganda. And he said that in his part of the world, people who are demonized, there are people who are compelled to go out into the bush and just to eat lizards that they have no desire to eat. This is what demons do to people. Now, Jesus, in the book of Matthew or any other gospel, has never turned down anyone who is asked to be healed. No one. In Matthew's gospel alone, I count some 11 accounts of Jesus healing specific people, in addition to all the accounts where it says that he healed many people, huge crowds, crowds of hundreds or thousands. And yet in verse 24, this woman comes to him, asks him for relief for her daughter, and he gives her a stiff arm. He rebuffs her and says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. That is, I was sent only to the Jews in the Jewish nation. Here's what he means, I think. The Bible is, of course, the story of God's rescue of us. And the Old Testament portion of the Bible was definitely complete by the day of Jesus. And the Jewish people had that Old Testament. It doesn't mean that most houses had a Bible in their home. No one could afford that. But they had it in their synagogues, and they had it in their temple, and they heard it read every Sabbath, and they memorized it in school. And so the words of Scripture were flowing through the minds of most Jews, even if they weren't particularly godly people. That Old Testament that the Jewish people had gave them a remarkable backdrop in thinking about how God saves people. That Old Testament informed them that God is both compassionate and holy. That he showed his compassion at the start by putting Adam and Eve in a stunning garden that was paradise. That he showed his holiness by throwing them out of that garden when they sinned with eating from the tree. That Old Testament showed them that the fall of human beings into sin brought nothing but misery, and that it was our fault. That God was prepared to kill everybody but 8 people in the entire world through a flood because that's how much he hates sin. That Old Testament showed that God gave 10 commandments that reflected his character, that he hates stealing, that he hates adultery, that he hates lying, that he hates the dishonoring of parents. That Old Testament taught the Jewish people how to worship God, and that God could only be approached through sacrifices, and that he could only be approached through some kind of a go-between, a mediator, a priest. You don't just go to God yourself. A priest helps you offer these sacrifices. And, of course, that Old Testament showed that God sent many prophets to declare that in the future, God would send a great king that would put small Israel back on the map. He would send a new David, a second David, a descendant of David, a son of David, who was Israel's greatest king, who would restore Israel to greatness and would forgive people's sins and would bless all the nations. Isaiah 49, verse 6 was in that Old Testament where God said to the Messiah, quote, "It is too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Israel to me. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, and you will bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." Now the Jews were able to understand these things because they had the Bible. And Gentiles who visited Israel, in doubtless, encountered this kind of teaching as they rubbed shoulders with Jewish people, or perhaps sometimes went to synagogue services or listened to Jesus preach. And thus you have several occasions right in the book of Matthew where Jesus healed Gentile people. In Matthew chapter 4, it says that people from all over Syria, including the area of Decapolis, which is non-Jewish, people came into Israel to be healed by Jesus, and he did so. And they rubbed shoulders with the teaching of the Jews while they were there. In Matthew chapter 8, we read that the Roman centurion, who was certainly Gentile, asked about his servant that God would heal him, and Jesus did. So Jesus did heal Gentiles, but he did Gentiles that came into Israel and got some form of the teaching from the Bible. But this woman, this lady, living in this part of the country, oh my goodness, she has no scripture. She has very little light. She is a Gentile in a Gentile land, and yet she wants a miracle. And she's not just a Gentile. She's a particular kind of Gentile. Mark calls her a Greek, but he does not mean that she's from Greece. He just means that's his word for a Gentile. But Matthew calls her a Canaanite. A Canaanite. These were the ancient enemies of the Jews. Do you remember that generations ago, God had promised Abraham that he would give the Jews the land of Canaan? And then, as Joshua and his armies moved the people of the Jewish people into Canaan, they took a map and they drew it out and they divided it into 12 sections, each section being given to one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And the tribe of Asher had been promised the land of Tyre and Sidon around it, which is called the land of Phoenicia. all that plain that goes along the coast, and the Lebanon mountains that rise up behind it. But we read in the Old Testament that the Jewish people were not able to overcome the Canaanites because the Jewish people lacked enough faith, and the Canaanites on the plain had iron chariots. And so the book of Judges, chapter 1, verse 31 says that the tribe of Asher did not drive out those living in Sidon or nearby coastal cities. And because of this, the people of Asher, that is Jewish people, lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Here now are foes side by side all the way through the Old Testament period. Jesus and his disciples are the children of those Jewish people that live side by side with Canaanites. This woman and her daughter are the children of the Canaanites that live side by side with the Jews and fought them in wars. This woman is a descendant then of the ancient enemies of the Jewish people, and yet she approaches the Jewish Messiah with a Jewish title that she calls him. She calls him Jesus, Son of David. Here is an outsider using insider language to approach the Son of God. She had no Hebrew Bible, and so she's liable to misunderstand what he is all about. She just heard the term, perhaps. And she is liable to think that the miracles are something on their own and not realize that they're meant to teach a deeper spiritual truth. John's gospel had said that John's gospel had called the miracles of Jesus signs. You know what a sign is? A sign is something that points away from itself to some other reality. 100 miles outside of Chicago, you'll see a sign that says, Chicago, 100 miles. You're not there yet. It's pointing you down the road. And so the miracles of Jesus were meant to be signs pointing away from themselves to a deeper spiritual truth. So Jesus feeds 5,000 plus people with five loaves miraculously. And then later he gives a sermon about how he is the bread of life that miraculously gives life to people. And that's the deeper meaning that he is interested in. But she has no grasp of this kind of thing, you think, because she has no background in the Bible. Particularly, she has no real grasp, it would seem, that God intends to give the gospel to the Jewish people first. And only then, as they spread the gospel to the entire world and they bring the Old Testament with them as a background to the message of the gospel and Jesus on the cross, she doesn't grasp that order to the Jews first with their Old Testament background and only later to the Gentile people. She is using, by using the term Son of David, she is using what Francis Schaeffer used to call God words, just words that sound pious and good because she's heard them, and maybe if I use them, I'll get some mileage out of that. And so the disciples, they don't want to give this woman the time of day, and they say to Jesus, she is bugging us like crazy. Would you please give her what she wants and let's move on and send her off? And Jesus replies to his disciples, probably in her hearing, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. In fact, it's almost certain that he replied to them, and that she is overhearing this. Have you ever had somebody who was angry at you? And so, like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, let's say, forgive me if there's a Smith here. Mr. and Mrs. Smith are not talking. And so Mrs. Smith says to her friend, would you please tell Mr. Smith that I'm not speaking to him? It's offensive. This is what Jesus is doing right here in her hearing to his disciples. He says, quote, I'm not going to give her what she wants because, quote, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. The point that we're making is this, really it's the point that Matthew is making. God is not going to save anybody without them having some understanding of the truth that's in the Bible. Whether they read it in the Bible, or hear the Bible read, or hear someone describe in his own words truth that is in the Bible. And so today you have people who are trying to gain God's help and his blessing by using God words that really have no biblical content to them, and God says he's not going to honor that sort of thing. And so people today all the time talk about faith. We have faith. Whoops, people of faith. I have faith. And yet it's not faith in any particular biblical Jesus or biblical God. It's just amorphous, mushy faith. It's nothing. It's less than vapor. And God will not honor anybody for that. Or you hear politicians endlessly, God bless America, God bless America. Yes, God bless America. Which God is that? And what is he like? Oh, we don't know, but may he bless America. This is the kind of thing that God will not honor. What God honors is the truth of the Bible that people claim by faith. Which brings us to our third and last point. And it is, I think, the high point of what Matthew is going after. And it's glorious. Matthew's third point is this. Even when God seems unresponsive, if we believe the Bible's promises, salvation will reach us. Even if God seems unresponsive, if we believe the Bible's promises, salvation will reach us. And that's shown in the fact that despite Jesus had his arm as stiff as a log toward her, she kept at him. Jesus said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Please, disciples, tell her that as it were. And she says, Lord, help me. He said, it's not right to take the children's bread, that is the Jews' bread, and give it to the dogs, that is the Gentiles. And she says, yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And as Jesus watches her push back in faith, he finally says to her, you have great faith, woman. Here is the question that plagued me for 2 weeks trying to get ready for this sermon. Where did she get that great faith? Because in the Bible, it's clear that faith is not something that can exist on its own. Faith has to be faith in something or someone. Faith has to have some content to grasp. Faith has to have a truth, a proposition, a promise, or something that it can say, I believe that and hold on to. Faith doesn't just hang in the air by itself. Where did that woman get any content to believe? What promise had she ever heard that she had faith to exercise upon? And I can think of three possible things. And the first is this. It is possible that she heard something about Jesus through other people from the area of Tyre and Sidon, because the Gospel of Mark, chapter 3, verse 8, makes clear that when people from all over Syria came to be healed by Jesus, it included people from the area, quote, around Tyre and Sidon. Maybe some of those people went to be healed, heard some of his messages, reported a couple sentences back when they returned. I don't know. That's one possibility. A second possibility is a little more intriguing, it seems to me, and it is this. It is just possible that this woman knew from tradition handed down by the people of Tyre and Sidon the story of the Old Testament prophet Elijah. Over 800 years earlier, the prophet Elijah, who was sent to the land of Israel, said, because the Israelites are worshiping idols, I declare there will be famine in the land and no rain for 3 years. This made him so hated by the king of Israel that he had to flee for his life. And God told Elijah to hide in several different places. One of the places that God told Elijah to hide in was a town called Zarephath. 1 Kings 17, verse 9, again, 800 plus years before Jesus, God says, quote, Elijah, go at once to the town of Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I've commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. Here is the idea. Sidon and Tyre were the two large cities, but there were small villages that would cluster around them. One of those villages clustering around Sidon was the town of Zarephath, and it was there that a certain pagan widow lived. Elijah went to her, saw her outside collecting sticks, and said, ma'am, could you give me a little water and make a cake for me? She said, sir, I am using the last of my flour and the last of my oil to make a cake or two, that is a bread or not, you know, don't picture birthdays, a cake or two for my son and me, and then we are going to die of hunger. And Elijah said, you feed me first, and as long as this famine lasts until the day it rains, you will have flour in your jug and oil in the other jug. And that's what happened. It is possible that as that story was told over the centuries, she had a little glimmer of light because Zarephath is so close to the area where she lived, and that she knew something about the God of Israel's interest in people outside of his own country. But the place that is most remarkable to me, in which it seems to me that she got some content, because you must have some biblical content to ever be saved. The place that is most intriguing to me that she got some content is in the words of Jesus himself, that he just slipped in very subtly between the sandwich of his other words to see how she would react. Here are the words of Jesus that gave the tiniest glimmer of hope to her that she latched on like a chihuahua on a pants leg. When he gave his third rebuff, he said, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." Oh, when you read that, doesn't it make you wince? Can't you just feel the harshness of his words? Don't you ache for that woman hearing the language coming like that out of the mouth of the Son of God? You know that for Jewish people, dogs were despised. You wouldn't touch a dog. Dogs were the scavengers. Dogs roamed the streets, and the only reason they were tolerated was because they would eat the trash and the garbage and at least clean things up a little bit. They were scavengers, they were fierce, and they were diseased. And so when Jesus says, it's not right to give the children's food to the dogs, he's saying it's not right to give the food that belonged to the Jews, God's covenant people for millennia now, and to give it to Gentiles. Oh, what harsh words. But there is a little glimmer of light. Jesus opened the door, I would say, the equivalent of an eighth of an inch. That's what she needed. Here's how he did it. Gentiles were more likely to keep dogs as pets than Jews, who never kept dogs as pets. And so when Christ spoke to her here, he uses a word that is not reflected necessarily in many versions of the Bible. He uses a certain word for dogs that means little dogs, little doggies. By that time in the Greek language, the use of the word little in a sentence often had no meaning, but it certainly has to have a meaning here. He's saying it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to not the scavengers, not the wild beasts that roam, but the little dogs that Gentiles will have in their house. A house dog, a pet dog. In other words, what he does, he puts her off for lack of knowledge. But there is the tiniest hint of gospel truths, and here is the tiniest hint. The dogs are not at the table, but by calling them pet dogs, as it were, he implies that maybe they'd be hanging around under the table. And if they're under the table, that means they're inside the house. She does two things. The first thing is she refuses to argue with him. Instead, she agrees with him. She does not say, "Oh, Lord, don't call me a dog. I'm a human being. I'm made in God's image. I have potential. My daughter has potential. She's sweet. She's beautiful. You should see her. If only you could see." She does none of that. Nor does she say, "Jesus, that is so harsh. Why would you favor the Jews over the Gentiles? Why would God choose to elect these people? They've done so much damage, and to oversee us? We have some good people living here in Tyre and Sidon." She will not argue that way. She says to him, "Yes, Lord," she agrees. That is, no salvation comes without agreeing with God in what he has said in the Bible, even when the things he says in the Bible are hard. And when God points his finger at us and says, "You do not deserve to go to heaven," no one goes to heaven who argues with him on that point and says, "Yes, I do deserve to go to heaven. Let me explain the good things I've done." She says, "I agree with you. Dog, I am God." But then she does the second thing. She clings to what little encouraging truth she did hear from Jesus. And she says, "Dog, I am. Dog, my daughter is. Yes. But you have implied that the dogs are at least in the house." And Jesus, everybody knows that when a father breaks the bread for the children, he knows some of those scraps are going to go down to those dogs. And so she shamelessly presses on him the logic of his own words, that God would be merciful to the Gentile dogs under the table. This is all the biblical truth she needed. And thus came true what Alfred Edersheim wrote in the 1800s about this passage. In saying this, the woman was no longer under the table, but had sat down at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and became a partaker of the children's bread. This is the wonderful thing that Matthew is going for, that the slightest glimmer of biblical truth that you grasp onto with your faith and refuse to let go, God will deeply honor. Let me close by mentioning two quick events in modern times that illustrate this rather well. I mentioned that Friday night I was in the presence of an American missionary who has been to Uganda for at least 12 years. He's the one who said that the demonized people in his area are sometimes impelled inexplicably to go out and eat lizards in the bush. He told us about a female witch doctor who is over 80 years old. This woman, he says, an exceedingly evil woman. If you see her any time of day, the look on her face is just piercing and dark and awful. He says she has been a witch doctor for over 60 years. Don't picture, he said, a witch doctor for some television show. He said, this woman actually deals with demons, with spells, with darkness. She's been involved in occult murders and so forth all her life. And she has been a total alcoholic for as long as anyone can remember. Sometime during the past 6 months, she said, I want to speak to you. Will you come to my house? I don't have time now. Please come to my house. I can come to you a day or two from now. Please come right now. Finally, she pressed on him and he came. And she said, I need you to know I have become a Christian. We've gone through this before, Grandma. You can't do this Christianity thing and do the demon worship at the same time. It just doesn't work. No, 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 she says, I really have. And she described for him in her own simple, knowledge-poor way, but with some sliver of truth that had reached her about her belief in Jesus and how she had turned away truly, and that she proved it by letting all her paraphernalia and the house in which it was enshrined be burned to the ground, despite the fact that it was worth many, many thousands of dollars. She totally lost her drive for alcohol immediately and has never struggled with it since. The Christians in this man's church do not believe, at least did not believe, that she was really a believer and gave her a hard time and did not extend fellowship or kindness to her, and many of them just held her at arm's length. But despite that, somewhere, somehow, some glimmer of truth got through the impenetrable wall of the darkness of her heart, and God granted her the faith to latch onto it, and she's been changed. And you will meet her and will talk with her one day in heaven. Secondly, some decades ago, a teenage girl, about 18, had a tragic accident and was paralyzed totally and became highly depressed over it. She became suicidal and attempted suicide and simply was unsuccessful in those attempts. She had several friends who would read scripture to her. And the scriptures they would read would sometimes focus on how God truly does have his reasons for allowing human suffering, and that if we yield to him, even though we don't understand those reasons, that he will eventually bring great good out of it, and we will be grateful for it. This girl came to the point where she said, okay, God, I have tried to kill myself and failed. As you know, I used to be extremely athletic, and now I can't even brush my own teeth or comb my own hair or put on my own makeup. And so, God, if I cannot know how to die, then please, would you teach me how to live? She is today loved all around the planet due to the book she's written and the movie she's made and the album she's recorded, and the love she has shown, but primarily due to the fact that she's founded an organization which I would believe is probably the largest disability ministry in the world that focuses not on just the Western world, but highly impoverished countries. Many of you can guess that I'm speaking about Johnny Erickson Tada, who 50 years ago today dove in the Chesapeake Bay and broke her neck. But in that darkness, some sliver of biblical truth worked its way into her, and it was enough to grab on to that. And that is what God used to turn her around, lift her spirits, and greatly use her to the extent now where she will be eternally grateful for this time in this wheelchair. I don't know what salvation you personally are in need of. I don't know what guilt you carry in your soul or what feeling of the pull of sin that you can scarcely resist that you are scared to death of. I don't know of the fear of the next life that you may have and of what will come after you die and of facing God on the great day of judgment. I don't know if you have a loved one who was held very much in the power of the devil, maybe not demonized, but 1 John says that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one, and you sense this in the life of somebody that you love. But if any of these things are true to you, what I urge you from this passage is this: find some biblical truth, even if it's just a sliver. Find a line in the Psalms. Find a single verse in the epistles. Find some small promise of God that he gives you in this life-changing book, and then hang on to it, claim it as yours, and do not let God rest until he gives you what you ask for. Will you bow your heads for the benediction? May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. Amen.